One of the common threads in a lot of the open water courses is a lot of lone wolves. A lot of people take diving that they come in, some come in with friends or a significant other, but you know, a lot of us come in just to try something different and we find we like it, and then we just kind of band together and find a different group. None of my close friends dive. Nobody in my family dives. So it's always something cool that I can bring to them.
It's episode 71 of Dive in the Podcast with special guest JP Angelopoulos. Dive in the Podcast is a weekly all about diving podcast for everyone. Whether you explore the oceans as a snorkeler, scuba diver, free diver, or tech diver, Dive In has something for you. The show is filled with diving news, feature guests around the world, interesting dive topics, and ocean advocacy. Visit diveinpod.com to find out about the show, past guests, and our Patreon. Hi, everybody. I'm Justin.
I'm April, and on tonight's Dive Girls Around the World segment, I'm going to tell you about an awesome Canadian diver.
I am Nick, and we're the hosts of Dive in the Podcast.
Before we start today's episode, I'd like to thank our listeners. Thanks for tuning in every week. Your support encourages us to keep going and make a bigger and better podcast. Last week, we had Natasha Tucker on from Plastic Oceans Canada. That was a great interview and full of information. And, you know, I still laugh because I now feeling guilty of have had quite a few iced coffees since recording that interview, and she's cut out iced coffees because you can't supply a cup. And then I just feel like a jerk every time I get one.
That's because you are a jerk.
It's because
I am a jerk. Wow.
That's so ice brutal. Cold. Ice coffee cold.
Ice cold.
Just kidding.
We also want to shout out a cool GoFundMe, the Ocean and Me Education Workbook. So there's a link in our show notes to help raise funds on this GoFundMe. There's two marine biologists with a passion for sharing knowledge and inspiring action in the next generation with master's and doctorate degrees in marine biology and experience in early childhood education. They're working hard to create an interactive, illustrated ocean education workbook for grades 4 to 6. So it's a really cool fundraiser. They're only trying to raise $4,000, which is practically nothing in the GoFundMe levels of money for fundraisers. So go check out that. The link is in the show notes. And we found that and we wanted to shout it out. The other thing we wanted to shout out is our hosts. This is travel season for work and vacation season for hosts. So this open is me, Nick, and April, and we're April and I are wrapping this up. The interview, I'm not actually on the interview. It was April and Amit and Nick. So, yeah, so you're not going to hear my golden tones during the JP interview. Sorry, guys. I know you'll miss out. I was off camping and sleeping under the stars while this was going on. So, yeah, let's head over and talk to JP. Tonight, we're speaking to JP Angelopoulos. JP is a PADI dive instructor from Nova Scotia, the resident ice diving specialty instructor at Torpedo Ray Scuba, and president of the Nova Scotia Underwater Council.
Welcome to the podcast, JP. Thanks for joining us. How are you doing today?
Doing all right, guys. Thanks for having me. Longtime listener and longtime friends with all you guys too. So it's nice to join you.
Yeah, it's one of those ones where like it's always great when we get to circle back home and hang out with somebody that we know really well. We're going to start your interview in a second, but before that, I had to ask you, JP, what's the most dangerous thing that you've ever found while diving?
Honestly, I don't think I've found too many dangerous things. Wish you had gave me a heads up on some of these questions there.
Oh yeah, this is a lead-in. Yeah. I'm gonna give you. Uh-oh. I'm setting you up for the news. So there was a Yellowknife diver who found and you'll like this because it's kind of along your MO. He found a beer can while diving, and the beer can had wires sticking out of it. And as a result of that, it turns out that they thought that there were some blasting caps. He's basically down, scooping up bottles, looking at cans and cell phones, garbage and what have you. And then a couple of days later, he finds this can that has what looks to be some blasting caps in it and some wires poking out of it. And so he calls the RCMP, who ends up driving up to Yellowknife to have a look at this thing and dispose of it. So it didn't go kaboom. And apparently nobody required robots to disarm it, or the, you know, they called it in the article here on CBC, the no robots and no moon suits were required. By the moon suits, I think they mean the bomb disposal suits that you've seen in all the movies. So it's one of these ones where I don't know if you've ever come across anything like that, but that must have been a different one for dude while he was out diving.
Nothing ever explosive, but I do know a couple of clearance divers for the military, and man, some of the stories they've told me about in the pitch black muck of a lake, they're literally just putting their hands into the muck slowly every time, looking for unexploded grenades or ordnances. And there's been some scary stuff I've heard about. And I looked into clearance diving a little while back. Well, if I was younger when I found out about it, I probably wouldn't have done it. But by the time I found out about it, I was not going to be able to make it. I can tell you that.
Yeah, you know what? It's definitely one of those ones where as soon as you introduce wife and kids and family, you're kind of like, yeah, its appeal is going right down the toilet. But, you know, that said, I'm with you. I know a couple of guys that do it. And yeah, all much respect for those guys. But I don't think that it's a thing that I'd be interested in overall. Okay, so we're going to take off from the news here and get started with JP Angelopoulos. JP, so you're originally from Nova Scotia, correct?
Born and bred in Dartmouth. Jumped the harbor in Halifax now, but I'll always be a Nova Scotian through and through.
And I know you're always one to organize a camp trip to some beach somewhere, or like we were talking about earlier, organizing a little trip. Did you have an early connection to the water?
Well, my family coming from Greece, you know, with a name like Angelopoulos, I've always been close to the water, whether it's been Nova Scotia or back in Greece visiting family. So it's always been kind of part of me. But funny enough, swim lessons weren't a big deal for me. Going to the ocean, the beach, yeah, you know, like any other kid in Nova Scotia. But it was never something I sought out on a continual basis, like a 12-year-old wanted to go surf, or a 15-year-old getting ready and like, oh, I'm going to go diving, get stuck in there. Diving for me didn't really start until my mid-20s. I mean, I'm 38 now, and I've been diving for 10, 15 years. I'm not even sure when I got certified at this point, but it just kind of started as a random adventure. I was doing a lot of traveling, want to find new adventures in different areas I went to. I've gone skydiving and bungee jumping, some real basic rock climbing. And I just thought, hey, you know, why not try diving? That sounds like something that'd be kind of cool to do. I did my open water here. And at that point, it just was no turning back. Advanced in Honduras, finished the rest of my courses here. And anywhere I go now, I try to make sure there's some good diving in the plan. Doesn't always work with a wife because she's not quite the diver. But for me, it's pretty much mandatory that I've got to bring my regulators anywhere I go and get ready to get wet.
Spoken like a true diver, but you're a scuba instructor these days. What drove you to become a scuba diving educator?
Pretty much, it's in my nature. Those you guys know me well enough, and I find it hard to not try to help people and try to, even if they don't want it sometimes, I always want to be there to help people to get on the right track. And that started even as a youth. I was a coach, soccer coach for a long time, coached all kinds of sports through high school, even rec leagues here as an adult. I've been a coach and manager, got involved in industrial safety. So my diving kind of led into oil and gas safety, safety diving, and a lot of those avenues, and it all came back to instructing. I have no problem getting in front of a class and putting on a presentation and sharing my knowledge or getting other people to share theirs. So it's just always been part of me. And when I started diving, became a dive master, and initially it was kind of the retirement plan. You know, hey, you know what? I'll just dive master now. Just knock out a few courses, and then when I'm ready to retire, I'll become an instructor, move to the Greek island somewhere, and just open a little dive shop and a little bar, and hey, that'd be great. And lo and behold, I got roped into it real fast, and I love it. A lot of my diving nowadays is around instructing, at least around here. And I love it. I try to help out with courses as much as I can, whether they're my own or others. It's tough. It's tough to squeeze a bit all the time because, well, all of you, you're all instructors. And you know, we don't do it for the money. We do it because we love it. And I love helping people out. And it's always great, especially with new students. with open water, just getting them on the right foot. Because I don't want to get into one of my rants from one of my open water classes, but you can be set on the wrong path real easily. And with bad habits or not respecting the process, procedures, the equipment, whatever it might be. So for me, it's like I try to instill as much knowledge of my own and from other people around me as efficiently as I can in the short time we have some of these new students. So again, I mean, you can tell I'm already ready to start rambling a teacher course right now, but I'll cut myself off there because I know I love it and it's just in my nature. It's always going to be.
So one of the courses that you teach every year is the ice diving course. And now we have listeners all over the world. So can you tell us a little bit about the ice diving course and what that's like?
Oh man, ice diving. Yeah, another one I just got into just to try it and be like, hey, you know, that's something cool to do. You can dive under the ice. Sounds pretty dangerous, which it can be. And I ended up becoming an instructor with it just because I started banging out a lot of the ice dives around here. Unfortunately, my ice diving is limited around the world, but I'm making a conscious effort to look into ice diving. There's some places in Hokkaido, Japan that I've been looking into, as well as across Canada, Manitoba, to do some really good ice diving. But with ice diving itself, it's not as complicated as people tend to think it is. It's just everything is that much more, you know, precautious because depending on the dive you're doing, if you're doing it in, you know, a flat lake, huge open area with, you know, a mile in each direction, you cut that hole with low visibility and you go under it. You're not finding your way back without a line. So then we, you know, we tie you to the line. Now you got a line to worry about. And if you're not a comfortable diver and now you're dragging a line behind you, you know, there's a lot of hazards that come up with that. So we got to make sure people are comfortable diving on tethers. And then you have to still dive with your buddy and you're connected to the surface. There's a whole nother communication method involved in that. So we got to make sure you're comfortable with that. The whole time, you are got to be a competent diver. So we always try to make sure that whoever's taking these ice diving courses is not just advanced, but very well comfortable in their equipment, in their gear. You know, we always say dry suit, but hey, I've trained a couple of people in wetsuits, and as long as you can handle it, great. But there is nothing like it. It's I'm not a cave diver yet, like some of my friends. I've done some cavern diving, but man, overhead environments is just it's a whole different world. And seeing ice from the underside and your bubbles dancing along the surface is just something you don't get to see too often, if at all, once a year for us, basically, maybe twice when I get a second or third course in. But yeah, it's a lot about procedures that we get to do depending on the lakes. But when we find a spot with some good visibility, it just adds a whole different light and a whole different viewpoint from diving.
Yeah, I think we had a pretty good luck this year up at the quarry with the ice diving course. But you mentioned all these challenges in teaching the course. You know, those are challenges that most, you know, open water scuba instructors obviously don't deal with. How do you deal with them? And you can kind of approach that question either on a personal level or on a level from teaching, because obviously you're taking on an increased risk. So, you know, how do you deal with those challenges?
Expectations. One of my key teaching points, and I guess part of my lesson plans, is laying out very clear expectations for anybody on my courses. When you start off diving open water, well, you don't really know what you're getting yourself into. So you know a little bit. You might have tried it in a pool, and hey, we may as well go and try this in the ocean. By the time you're ready to go under the ice, one, you better be well experienced, and you better be prepared. And if at any point I don't feel you're prepared, or I don't think you're going to be competent, or you're going to put myself, yourself, or another trainee in danger, you know, you're done. I'll send you home, and I don't even care if it costs me money on there. I'm not going to risk that. So laying out very clear expectations and keeping it as professional as I can while still having a good time, because we all want to do the same thing there. But I always find that if you lay it out very clearly at the beginning, you need to respect these processes. You need to respect these procedures. If you don't, you're putting yourself, you're putting me, and you're putting other people at risk. What you do after the course is up to you. And I'm hopefully going to instill that sense of pride in those procedures, in those protocols, and in that safety, so you can take that to other people as well. That's always my goal. I can't control you. There's no scuba police, as much as we'd love to see them. But I really enforce that as best I can. All the while, I still want to have a good time. And fortunately, I've never failed an ice diver. Pretty sure everybody's passed. There's been one or two people that have we've had some difficulties, but we get them through it. We've had some free flows, some entanglements, but that's why I'm there with them the whole time, or I've got my assistant instructors there with me, or other well-qualified personnel on standby. So expectations and always good preparation, and hopefully a barbecue at the hole as well.
Well, that definitely sounds like, a good way to do things is to have those things set out in place ahead of time, and that, people know that you're taking it seriously enough to bounce them from a course if they're going to end up horsing around and not adhering to those safety principles, because certainly overhead environments can be a difficult and dangerous thing, like you mentioned, and, you add the lines and all the rest of it. So I got to ask, because, you put a lot of information out there in those two pieces. And one of the reasons that I think I enjoy teaching is because I do feel that from teaching, I end up learning quite a bit. What would you say is the biggest thing that you've learned from teaching an ice diving course?
I want to say, expect the unexpected, but I feel like that's misleading, because overall, in the 3 or 4 years I've been teaching ice diving, the majority of my trainees have been pretty damn good. They've mm-hmm. been very diligent, following procedures. Now, I guess the biggest lesson I would take from that is don't let your guard down, because that's when everything goes wrong. Safety is my profession. I work in industrial safety. I'm always checking construction sites. I work at the hospital in a lot of their areas, and we can't take anything for granted. So even though things are going great, we have to be prepared. The handful of small incidents we've had, we've been able to deal with very easily and very comfortably, because people took the right precautions, took the right procedures. But for me, I guess I'd have to say it's don't let the guard down, because you get too comfortable and that's when things go wrong and you're not prepared. And, I've had to chew out a few people who weren't fully prepared from time to time. They might have been not fully geared up at the hole to help, or, sipping on a coffee when somebody needed help there. And, I basically just get everybody to the hole, stand down, lay into you for a minute, and then say, okay, we got that out of the way now, guys. We all good. Let's make sure we don't do it again, and let's have some fun. So some people said I'm harsh sometimes, and I try not to be, but I feel like sometimes you need to be to make sure people right. don't get too comfortable.
Right. You say you have a background in industrial safety. If you had one thing that you would take from that background to the ice diving course, if you could, or is there something that you see from that domain that could apply to the ice diving course, what would that be?
Preparation and procedures. It's, people get complacent and get too comfortable with stuff. Oh, yeah, we're just jumping in the hole, tie off, you're good. We got you. Pull you back if you need it. Having your lines checked, making sure that they're secured, making sure you're not clipped onto a rusted small piece of metal as opposed to a proper D-ring on a harness or on your BCD. Is your harness anchored? Are you anchored? Are you fully kitted, ready to help? My day-to-day job working in industrial safety, it's all about making sure people are prepared and are ready to deal with emergencies or injuries or anticipating these things. And all these things will happen can happen in ice diving. Can happen all diving, but we just discussed how ice diving can really amp these things up. So anticipating and preparing as best as possible, checking your lines, making sure they're, making sure they're not frayed or that they're secured, or making sure you're clipped onto a proper D-ring as opposed to, a small piece of metal that's wrapped around your other clip or something like that. There's a lot of things that people tend to overlook, they get too comfortable with, and taking those procedures and making sure people aren't complacent is a huge portion of my day-to-day life. And I definitely want to bring that into ice diving. And when it comes to emergency planning, it's no different if you're a firefighter, police officer, paramedic. I've trained and worked with a lot of these people before. And I'll tell you, making decisions is key. because you could have the best laid out plan in the world, you know, steps 1 to 10 to deal with an emergency. And ask anybody in those professions, how often does the plan go 1 to 10? Absolutely never. It's so many decisions you have to make in between steps 1 to get to step 10. And I always want my people, my trainees, whether it's day-to-day work or scuba trainees, to make sure they know how to make proper decisions. One of the things I always preach to anybody in any of my courses is everything I teach you, everything I tell you, I will have a reason for it. And if I can't explain why I want you to do this or to do that, then why am I telling you to do that? There's a rare occasion where, you know, some sort of scientific, you know, biological thing says do this and I don't understand it. I just know that, okay, scientists said do that. But in general, when it comes to procedures or to something, you know, something that I'm instructing you to do, if I can't explain the benefit to it or why you shouldn't do it, then why am I telling you? And I always encourage my trainees to say, if you come up with a better way, tell me. And I'll explain why I think it's good or why I think it's bad. And we'll go forward with the best decision possible. And that's all we can really hope for.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think too, in the ice diving course, that's a big thing. We always do some brainstorming and find new ways and better ways to do things over the years. But moving away from some of that, you've done a lot of diving in Nova Scotia, but where else have you been able to dive?
So started here in beautiful cold water, Nova Scotia. Next was down in, no, open water. I actually, funny enough, I met up with the two other people that took my open water course here in Greece. They happened to be going, it was a couple going on their honeymoon. And I told them to meet me in at the island my mom's from in Milos. And we met there and we went for a couple dives there. So that was pretty great. So I've done some diving in Greece, Honduras. I was in Utila to do my advanced course, which was fantastic. I was actually just going there to do some dives and I got roped into an advanced course because it happened to be starting that day and got free accommodations at the Utila Dive Center. I was like, all right, great. So that was fantastic. Then I did some diving in Cozumel and Tulum. I got to dive some cenotes down there, which was just so great, man. Like you'd drive a half hour in the jungle and there's a hole. I'm like, all right, jump in the hole. We're going diving. It's like, that's right up my alley. Indonesia. That was one of my favorite spots. It was a toss-up for a trip in 2016 to go to Vietnam or Indonesia. Worked out to be about the best, about the same price for both trips. And the diving in Komodo Island was just like glass, diving with manta rays that were 3-4 meters wide. Maybe not 4 meters wide, but they were massive, absolutely gorgeous. Some diving around Lombok as well in Blongus Bay, which I heard was a great spot to go see hammerheads. I was a little out of season, but it was a little more intense. Got to do some current diving too. So that was pretty cool. Hooking onto a reef and just hanging out there while everything rushes past you instead of drift diving, you know, going with it. And I'm missing something in there. What am I missing? Colombia. I was down in Taganga. Brain corals that were like the size of a house. Massive, really cool spot to check out.
Sounds like you've been around, though. That's a positive thing.
As much as I can. Again, I haven't been around as much as other people, but I definitely try. And traveling's always been a big part of my life.
So is there something about the cold water of Nova Scotia that you like? And maybe you think that it might surprise people who haven't dove here before?
I don't know how many people like cold water. It's got its benefits. Cold water diving can be great, but I don't think we dive it because it's cold. It's surprising how good diving can be here in Nova Scotia. And I mean, we got so much coastline, we got shipwrecks all over the place, and a lot more here than people realize. And I mean, we've taken people out diving that just want to see lobsters because they're from another area in the world and they don't have lobsters like we do. And we're basically saying, geez, they're like rats here. They're everywhere. We just, you know, they happen to be there. I took a couple divers out a year or two ago from California and they just want to see our kelp. And they were just like, they're kelp scientists. And we're like, we hear you guys have amazing kelp. I was like, okay. Took them down Ketch Harbor, Portuguese Cove, that area, Bear Cove. And they were just, you know, flabbergasted with all the varieties and the style of the kelp that we had here, which I know very little about. But I'm actually learning a fair bit about that with a couple of projects that that I'm working on right now that hopefully we'll get to in a few minutes. But the fact that cold water diving can be so great, it seems to scare people away. But one of the things I'm trying to do as a Nova Scotia Underwater Council is to encourage people to come to Nova Scotia for diving, because we really feel Nova Scotia's got a lot more to offer than people realize, and it can be a dive destination around the world.
That's really great. And I think that's going to lead us into our next segment. But before we do that, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more from JP Angelopoulos. This episode of Dive In the Podcast is brought to you by Torpedo Rays Scuba.
You can find them online at torpedorays.com.
They've been teaching Canada how to dive for 25 years and are a proud sponsor of this podcast.
If you're in Atlantic Canada and want to take a course or see the shop, stop in and see us in Dartmouth and check out the huge selection of scuba, apnea, surf gear, and much more.
Dive tours are available for locals and visitors to experience all that our ocean playground has to offer.
TorpedoRays.com has a vast selection of dive gear at unbeatable prices, with free shipping available in Canada and quick shipping throughout North America.
So visit TorpedoRays.com or stop in the shop, and you might even see one of us there.
Welcome back to Dive In the Podcast. We're speaking with JP Angelopoulos, an ice diving instructor and president of the Nova Scotia Underwater Council. So, JP, you led the way to rebooting the Nova Scotia Underwater Council about 3 years ago. Why were you interested in doing that in the first place?
Well, funny enough, it was basically just asking a few questions about, you know, why don't we have more shipwrecks? Why don't we have more reefs? Why don't we have more dive promotion? And it was on a charter to the Saguenay with Bill Flowers, you know, Captain Bill there. And I just asked a question. I was like, hey, man, why are you saying you helped sink the Sag? You know, why not? Why don't you do it again? And, you know, we just got chatting a bit, and, you know, he's got a business, he's busy and this and that. And I was like, well, you know, why don't we try to do it again? I'm sure there's other ships out there we can get our hands on. And he said, well, you know what? Here's a couple of people you can contact and see where it goes. And Rick Welsford, one of the past presidents of the, it was at that point a dissolved Underwater Council, I gave him a call and just said, hey, I'm JP, you know, local dive instructor, is talking to Bill. He said, you were president of the Underwater Council, you helped sink the Sag. Just wondering, you know, hey, how'd you do it? Are there other people that are willing to do stuff like that? Yada, yada, yada. And after, you know, about 3 or 4 hours, a good robot brewery down here in the North End, we basically talked about it. And he just said, if you want to restart the council, you can go ahead and get some legs behind it. And then I was just talking to divers like you guys, just, you know, divers around Nova Scotia, had a couple very impromptu meetings. Hey, who's interested? Would people get behind this? Is there an appetite for something to be put together to organize the divers in Nova Scotia? There's a Ontario Underwater Council. There's a BC one. I believe there's even a Manitoba one, if that's still around. I can't remember at this point right now. But, you know, why don't we have one in Nova Scotia? So everybody was supportive. After a few more meetings, a little bit of effort from a few people, we put together some bylaws, a charter, had an election. I was I won the election for president. It was you know, not too many people were running for it at that point, so it was it wasn't the most difficult run there. But everybody was very supportive. The unfortunate part though was just as we started kind of getting our feet wet and figuring out what we're capable of and what we could, because we bit off way too much than we could chew at the beginning. And once we kind of figured out here's some directions we can go, that was right about mid-2019, end of 2019, and all of a sudden COVID hits.
Right.
And a lot of things, you know, we all went through it. We don't have to rehash all this. But it shut down a lot of the projects and a lot of the opportunities. We ran some hurdles. But fortunately, we were able to kind of keep it together, keep the communication open. Myself and the other executive members have been working on some projects in the background. And now that things are opening up, vaccinations are getting up there, and we can have some gatherings, we've got a couple options out there. And, you know, we can touch base on a few of these now or later. And, man, there's so many things I want to do. It's almost, you know, that's a whole podcast on its own.
So before we get into that, can you, maybe in a few brief words, kind of tell us maybe why the original Nova Scotia Underwater Council was dissolved? Was it just created to sink the SAG and then kind of lost its purpose kind of thing? Or do we know a bit more?
It kind of became obsolete. The original purpose of the Underwater Council was to promote dive safety. Dive safety regulations, some promotion. It wasn't a huge tourism promoter, but a lot of it was about diving regulations and safety because it was in the, you know, mid to late 80s and into the 90s. And some of the major diving associations were just getting their feet wet to start pushing the regulations. So once all the standards and practices of diving became much more common and much more proficient and effective, to be honest, they kind of ran out of things to do. I shouldn't say ran out of things to do. They have lots to do. But a lot of them kind of, I don't want to say aged out, but they were, you know, moving on with their lives and had other things on the go. So there wasn't a new generation of divers to take it over. And I guess our generation of divers, and I'll just speak, you know, very generally there, didn't really, I don't want to say didn't see a need for it, but maybe just didn't realize it. We were just too busy enjoying diving, just seeing, hey, we got lots of ocean. Let's jump in here. Let's jump in there. Let's travel. This is all so easy for us to get all the diving we want. Oh, you want a good shipwreck? Man, you can travel here, there, anywhere. But I'd love to see people focus more here and say, we can do a lot more with the diving in Nova Scotia, whether it's sinking shipwrecks, whether it's promoting projects, you know, marine conservation. And hey, you know, St. Margaret's Bay is a fantastic diving area. You can put a couple of B&Bs around there, which there already are. You can have a week of diving and have a great time. So I don't know if it just kind of fell by the wayside and people were a little complacent. But I'm glad people got behind it as soon as we brought it up. And hopefully now that we can get things going again, we'll be able to see some real progress.
And what is the council's mission now?
The standard mission statement is to promote Nova Scotia diving, marine conservation, and the development of underwater parks and reefs and artificial reefs. At this point, we've started a lot of these things. We haven't been able to complete any major projects right now. We had a few setbacks on an underwater park. We had an artist actually ready to go, had a whole design set up, had a mini to scale model of a concrete structure we were going to put down in St. Margaret's Bay to kind of give us a diving attraction in relatively shallow water that you know, a lot of people could enjoy from a shore dive. And unfortunately, the artist had to go back out west, fell ill, and needed to go home for some time and had to kind of back out of the project. So we've been looking into some other artists at this point and some other projects along those lines. But we're still working as best we can, and we've run into a lot of hurdles, and hopefully we're going to come out on the other side of this with some great stuff for Nova Scotians to enjoy and hopefully the rest of the world too.
Yeah, well, you know what? One of those things, JP, I can say, I haven't known you for, well, I think we're getting on to 6 years or so now. I don't think there's any quitting you, bud. So I'd expect that regardless of whatever hurdles that you're experiencing, you're just going to keep pushing and we're going to end up getting something great. But, you know, one of the things I did want to touch on was that the Underwater Council, Nova Scotia Underwater Council, or NSUC, has been working towards creating these artificial reefs like you talked about. And, you know, that's not an easy thing. I mean, if we go back and chat with Bill about that, you know, when he was looking to sink the SAG, he'll tell you that it wasn't just like a, hey, let's sink this boat and then off we go, right? So we're going to touch a little bit more on some of the specific projects that you're working on. But what has been the process or experience like for you in terms of planning and, I guess, visioning what these artificial reefs might look like in Nova Scotia?
Planning and visioneering, however you want to say it there.
envisioning.
Sure. Yeah, that's probably the right word. That's the fun part. That's the easy part. Oh, I can see The cormorant right there on the Port of Bridgewater. I can see that sunk in the bottom of the ocean with compartments and tracks, and we'll put plates up with people's names on it who donated money, and you know, access points here, here, here. The planning and the dreaming part is so easy. Unfortunately, and as you alluded to Bill's comments, it's not as simple as just, all right, hey, we're going to take this and drop it in the ocean. The Saguenay was a less than a year from conception to sinking. And that was back in the 90s. And I don't want to say unfortunately, but now we have much more strict regulations. We are not allowed to just take a ship, take a derelict vessel, take anything and drop it in the ocean. There's obvious exceptions with certain things, but we definitely need to make sure that we're doing everything by the book. And we want to. We want to work with the government, work with the proper authorities to do things properly. Unfortunately, I feel like people have been pretty gun-shy with artificial reefs. They just think it's dumping stuff in the ocean. There was a couple of projects out in BC that ended up, I don't want to say ended up bad, but they had some political fallout and a lot of people upset about different things. Now, around here, it's a lot of red tape. It's a lot of regulations. And I've done so many online submissions and planning and different documents and following up on them, making sure that they're completed afterwards, that we're talking to the right people is always, it's tedious. It's monotonous. And we get the runaround sometimes because people that we're asking, this hasn't been done in 20 years, 20, 30 years, and they're not sure, oh, who do I talk to about this? How do I talk to this person? Oh, maybe this person. Who's got the authority? And then nobody wants to sign off on it. So it becomes a little more difficult, but a lot of people are very supportive. They want it to happen, but it's just they're always a little scared about the one person saying, oh, this is bad for the environment. And when they quote some article that they found on Google here somewhere saying, oh, artificial reef's bad. But then I show them 10 scientific articles or take you down to the Saguenay and see how much marine life and growth has happened from artificial reefs. It's pretty cut and dry. When you do it well, it's very clear and the benefits are right there. So we have a lot of hurdles to jump through, and there's lots of lessons learned. But if there's nothing else that I can take out from this, is that when we do finally sink an artificial reef emit, there will be some veggie burgers waiting for you. All right?
Sweet, buddy. Now we're talking. Awesome. Now we're talking.
So barbecue by the ice hole, then a barbecue by the artificial reef. I love that.
I'm working on a new scuba certification. It's called a Paddy Grillmaster, and hopefully they grant me certification for that.
Is it going to be a Paddy bartender too?
I can. Me and Amit actually were planning that on a dive a while back, having some inflatable bars by the boat. It would
nice.
I think it could work. Yeah, and just for the backstory for this, for the people listening here, I think we got to throw it. So I'm a vegetarian, and I will say JP gets like the number one grill master credits because he built a barbecue for a dive day just for the hell of it one day. And he was considerate enough to find out before I got there that I was a vegetarian and reserved part of the grill with separate utensils just for vegetarian food. So I got to throw the props in there and put some context around
that's
comment.
Awesome. But,
you missed out because I had lamb roasting over charcoal, and the lamb juice was dripping right on the grill. And I had to make a special spot for your veggie burgers where the lamb juice didn't hit it. But you missed out, buddy. You missed out.
I guess it depends on perspective, but I appreciate the effort you went to. And that was a hell of a contraption that you built to make.
Funny
that
enough,
happen.
I didn't build it. I'm going to give credit to Alistair. Alistair Ford, I think, yeah. A fellow diver. He's a welder. And I told him the idea, and he was just like, yeah, I could probably do that. And I gave him the drum. I gave him a couple things, and I came back a week later, and he had it all built up. I just moved it to the new house that I'm moving into this week.
Nice.
I'm going to try to find a permanent spot for it because it's still great.
You were talking about artificial reefs and sinking wrecks, and And some listeners who know, you know, Nova Scotia, we know that the approaches to the harbor are littered with wrecks. So just kind of playing devil's advocate a little bit, might it not be a better use of time to try to develop the diving around the existing wrecks rather than creating new ones?
Well, it depends on the wrecks that you're referring to, and you definitely could. But when you ask about developing the dive site around a current shipwreck, what are your expectations? We build a dock so people can dock their boat and pick up divers. That's one option that we have thought of before. But outside of that, I mean, I'm not really sure how we can help develop current wreck sites. Is there something in mind you had? I mean, I'm always up for ideas.
I come from, I grew up in the Caribbean and I grew up in a resort setting and everything's boat diving. That's one thing I think our community is not really sort of used to, right? So I was wondering if that was maybe an approach. I wasn't trying to be critical to what the NSDUC is doing. I'm just sort of playing devil's advocate here. So
no, I'm very curious because we do have a number of shipwrecks. Some aren't as accessible as others, and not many people have approached to try to say, hey, can we make these ones more accessible? Now, a lot of the shipwrecks that I've been around here, calling them shipwrecks is generous. It's rubble. It's a boiler that's still intact and some wood scattered around, and you'll find a couple, you know, mortar shells if you're lucky in some of these spots. Speaking of dangerous things you can find there. But what we were hoping is to make a more a very attractive dive site. And one of the things that we applied for in conjunction with the Canadian Artificial Reef Society out in BC was to take the Cormorant, which has unfortunately been stripped, towed to Sheet Harbor to be scrapped into razor blades, basically. We wanted to sink that very close to the Saguenay. And myself and a few other divers, we did a scouting dive on a site very close to the Sag. And if you were to tell somebody that you have the Saguenay dive, which is great on its own, and 10 minutes away, or not even 10 minutes away, around the corner, you've got a former Navy dive vessel that has massive swim-throughs and compartments that you can dive off the same boat, you know, an hour after you get up. I mean, come on. And where do you dock? You dock in Lunenburg, where you've got great restaurants, great accommodations, mm-hmm. amazing people, which is an hour from Halifax. Tap in another half hour on the highway to the airport. You could fly in to Halifax International Airport, drive straight to Lunenburg, you know, check in your accommodations, have a great dinner, wake up early the next morning, do three dives on the Sag. Come up the next day, you do three dives on the Cormorant. And there's your weekend. And then you leave on Monday. I mean, that's a hell of a long weekend, if you ask me. And that's the type of thing we would love to see here in Nova Scotia.
Yeah, for sure. That would be awesome. And can you tell us a little bit about the Young Teaser Artificial Reef Project?
So after the Cormorant, well, there was a couple of things. One, we looked at the Cormorant right away and realized we might have bit off more than we can chew. And we kind of set that aside. And there was another vessel, a trawler, just down on the same port and called the Rupert Brand, which was to be dumped off the continental shelf ages ago, long ago, but it was still there. Derelict vessel, fishing trawler. Was it 50 more than that? 100 feet long, maybe, and about 30, 40 feet tall. And then we thought, hey, maybe we can clean this one up and we can make this into a vessel, make this into a shipwreck. Cormorant came up again with a Coast Guard grant, which we applied for, just got into, yada, yada, yada. So that's gone. And now we're back onto the Rupert Brand, which we have renamed the Young Teaser. So this kind of came up from an old pirate myth in Home Bay. And now this isn't the pirate ship, but there is a myth that there was a vessel called the Teaser that was a pirate ship, but it ended up being chased down and then blown up by its captain somewhere off the coast of Mahone Bay. And there's even a few shops in Mahone Bay there, which is, you know, around the corner from Lunenburg, basically. And that are called the teaser. So this has been part of their local folklore for a little while. So one of the things Rick Welsford and I were talking about is we could take this trawler, you know, get it ready for sinking and take it to where we think, quote unquote, the young teaser was actually, you know, exploded and ended up at the bottom. And we can build the whole story, the legend, the myth around that. So you can build a story about it. Some of the best things about, you know, wreck diving is knowing the story and history of what you're diving on. Now, granted, I'm not trying to sell this as an actual pirate ship, but at least it, you know, gives you a chance to talk about that story sure. on the boat ride out there. Afterwards, mm-hmm. you're having the beer, and we'll have some pamphlets, and we'll have some information on Mahone Bay and the teaser and what might have happened. And you can tie that to your dive where, hey, you know, we were down there, you know, scoping out this, you know, fishing trawler. But it's actually a pirate ship, and I'm sure I'm going to put a pirate flag on it. So that'll be an easy thing to do in the midst.
I support putting a pirate flag on it.
Always.
100%.
Yeah, I think I do too. Yeah, but even basically like finding some way to laser cut that pirate flag into the metal so it stays there for a long period of time.
Now he's thinking.
Always thinking there, Amit.
Reduce ocean pollution too, right? Yep. I mean, hey, we got to think blue.
There you go.
We found a spot that that could work out quite well for it. Myself and a couple of divers scoped it out a few weeks ago, and nothing on the bottom, nothing to worry about. Flat, sandy bottom, a little more silty. Our visibility that day wasn't the best, but we'd just gone in after a storm. And funny enough, as we were going out, the sonar was basically pinging the floor, and it was like, oh yeah, 60, 70 feet, and where everything was flat, there was two little pings at about 40 feet. And they weren't little pings. They were kind of long. And I look at it and I go to Rick. I'm like, whoa, what's that there? And he's just like, I don't know. Could be seals, but probably sharks. Because we get sharks in Mahone Bay. And oh, man. So that was sitting in the back of our heads the whole dive. Now, the two divers I was with, they had scooters. So I'm sure they were fine. But I did not. So that old adage, if you, I don't have to outrun the bear. I just have to outrun you. I guess they only had to outswim me. And yeah, they would have beat me pretty easily on that one.
That's funny. And then there was, I believe there's maybe the potential for a collaboration with an organization called IntelliReefs. Is that right?
Yeah, so this is very interesting. This was brought to me, funny enough, not through normal channels. A friend of mine, he works for a venture capitalist company here in Nova Scotia, and he reached out to me because I'm a diver. And he just said, hey, man, like, what do you know about artificial reefs? And, you know, we're friends, but I don't even know if he knew I was president of the Underwater Council or how involved in this stuff I was. I was like, well, man, I'm working on these projects. He said, okay, well, let's have a chat. There's a company that just reached out to us about trying to do some reef projects here in Nova Scotia. And I was like, perfect. So I sat down with him, and it's called IntelliReefs. And you can go to IntelliReefs.com. And these guys build artificial reefs using nanotechnology and a bunch of scientific mumbo jumbo stuff that I don't know about. I just like seeing it, and it looks great. They've done a lot of projects down in the Caribbean and Saint Martin mostly, and they're basically growing coral reefs artificially and seeing how this growth develops. And they base the type of coral or whatever it is that they are planting there on the marine environment. And one of the scientists that is working on the project, she's from here. She's from Nova Scotia. So she thought it'd be a great idea to try to bring it up here. So after a quick conversation with my buddy, I set up a call with IntelliReefs. Myself, I brought Rick in there and the NSUOC executive. And we started chatting about different types of projects that we have. And I highly encourage people to go check out their website because they're doing some really cool stuff. Well, one of the things that I loved seeing was a very touristy thing, because for me, it's two things. As part of the Underwater Council, I want to promote diving in Nova Scotia. And two, marine conservation and artificial reefs. So these guys should be able to do both. One of the things that they do down in Saint Martin was they have a structure built under the water in the shape of a turtle. And the turtle has, and it's pretty big, it's probably, you know, 30, 40 feet long maybe. And it's got a couple different spots on it, like, you know, holes. And on the shore, you go and buy a piece of coral. you do your dive, you go down and find the turtle, and you plant your coral right on the turtle itself. So the proceeds go towards the development of artificial reefs, and you're physically planting part of the reef itself. So you're very well involved in it. And it gives you that extra connection to the ocean, which especially I think new divers would absolutely love. Now, unfortunately, Nova Scotia, we don't have the abundance of coral growing, so that might not be an option. But they're looking into what we could grow here. And I mentioned kelp earlier with a couple California scientists that I was diving with. And that might be one of the things they're looking into, is trying to develop major kelp forests or other, I'm not even sure what else they would love to do. But providing all the work permits and paperwork and all the economical stuff, which, again, I don't know about. If that goes through, hopefully we'll get a couple of them up here and we're going to support them, get diving, take some samples and see what they think they could help grow here.
That's pretty cool.
Turning that into a dive attraction here where you can help support and help grow marine life in addition to enjoying your dive. I mean, for me, that's just an added element to your diving, which could be great.
So the other thing you're trying to grow, other than kelp potentially, which I think sounds like an awesome project, that if only for a pilot project to kind of experiment with things or build something bigger. But the other thing you're trying to build is this community, and you mentioned this a little earlier in terms of the challenges with COVID. And I know that April has had her challenges with the sea foxes during COVID and the Halifax Freediving Club. You know, we kind of went through a rough patch last year because it's a very close contact sport. And you know, and I was also kind of thinking a little bit to the context that you guys just kind of got started in 2019-ish. And I think you got to give yourself a little bit of credit, right? Organizations also take time to grow. What do you see the way forward post-COVID, if we kind of focus away from that experience? How do you see that going forward?
I'm hoping that once we get a clear plan in place for the Young Teaser and Antelo Reefs, then I'll be able to reach out to the NACC and the dive community of Nova Scotia with specific goals and specific actions that we can take. I've been involved in lots of community organizations, whether it's the Greek community of Halifax, whether it's the sports and soccer community. Hey, I used to breakdance back in the day, and we had a whole community of breakdancers. So I've been involved in a lot of things. The biggest difference that the Underwater Council has with organizations like that, or the Sea Foxes or other dive communities, it's not as much as, hey guys, let's get together and go for a dive. It's, hey guys, let's get together and get to work, because it's not always going to be fun things to do. It's not always going to be, hey, we can go enjoy a dive here, or we're going to, go see this or go see that. I'm going to be asking people like, hey, can you deal with paperwork with the government? Can you look into these processes and this funding opportunity here? Can you help lug trash and take down a wall from inside of a shipwreck? And it can be very difficult. Now, to the dive community's credit, when I have asked for people to come out, and especially with some of the government protocols, I've had people volunteer and really jump in and want to help. And I think people want to have more of a purpose when they're diving nowadays. It's one thing to go in and just enjoy your dive, but it's another thing to say, hey, we're going out here for a reason as well. We're going here to support the rest of the dive community. What we're going to do today is going to help Nova Scotia diving and the Nova Scotia community, down the road. And I don't want to get too preachy with, saying, hey, we're helping everybody and it's a kumbaya kind of thing. But I do feel that people inherently want to see the community do well, and we all benefit from it. The dive community, the marine environment, Nova Scotia tourism, there's no losers in this. It's, except for me somewhere with my own money, but that's about it.
Yeah, I think, communities are built, by different people in different ways. And I don't think there is a right way or wrong way. So, whatever you do is just, you're playing your part in a bigger ecosystem. And I think, like you said, there can't really be any losers. One of the issues that we have in Nova Scotia, and most divers here will know that, is access to dive sites and the challenges around that. And maybe new divers don't maybe necessarily see that right away, because they kind of go to like the main dive sites and they you dive those for a while, and maybe it takes a while for them to dawn. And maybe for listeners in other parts of the world, access could also be an issue. How would you characterize the issue of coastal diving access here locally? And does it get better or worse?
It is a touchy subject at the least. And funny enough, this was one of the first things we tried to tackle back in 2018 when we started. And Cliff Andrews, my vice president, spent a lot of time looking into a lot of the coastal access laws or bylaws in Nova Scotia. And there's a lot of stuff out there, almost too much stuff. And not just too much, but too old. A lot of the bylaws have not been updated. I don't want to say in like 100 years, but some of the stuff he was telling me about was ridiculous, how old it was, where one of the laws, don't quote me exactly on this, but there was something along the lines of you cannot block coastal access for somebody hunting or fishing, you know, for who needs access to the water for hunting and fishing, which basically means if you've got a beachfront property and I need to go fish off your beach, you can't stop me. And nowadays, who goes fishing off a random beach or a random coastline in the, you know, off the South Shore somewhere or the Eastern Shore? And it's gotten very touchy because, you know, all of us in certain areas have come across locals or residents who claim that, hey, this is private property, you're not allowed on it. And then we look at it and it looks like a public road. So can you tell me not to be on this, or do you just not want me to be on this? You know, it's all for us here. Or, hey, I own this land up until this point, you can't access this. And we want to be respectful. We always try to be respectful. I don't speak for everybody, but I'm sure most of us want to be respectful of the locals and the residents as best as we can. But at a certain point, you know, we're Canada's ocean playground. We want to make sure we can play in the ocean. And when people start to buy up oceanfront property and say you can't access it, well, are you allowed to? And some of these laws are very outdated and they need updating. Unfortunately, a lot of the headway we tried to make got stumped pretty fast. And it's one of the things Cliff and I were discussing the other night. Hopefully he's going to pick it up a little bit. He had to take a little leave of absence right now, and I'm hoping he'll be able to kind of pick up where you left off on that to see if he can gain some headway. And it's not about us trying to take over the beaches and take over somebody's beachfront property and, you know, us plant our flags and say, hey, we're all diving here now. It's just about being respectful and understanding everybody's rights. You know, if we can now come across and tell the divers in Nova Scotia, if somebody tells you you can't access this, ask them this question. And if they can't show you this document or whatever it is, or if, you know, whatever it might be, just politely tell them we have rights to get in here. We're not trying to, you know, ruin your land. We don't want to be disruptive, but we have just as much right to the ocean as you do. And it's, like I said, it's very touchy. Some people have a very hard line on this and don't want to budge, and others don't want to get involved. And it's those people who don't want to get involved that we need to kind of bring into the fold to make some real decisions in there.
So what kinds of solutions or options does the dive community have with regards to access?
Unfortunately, I can't give you any concrete solutions right now. Ideally, it would be along the lines of understanding our rights, not just our rights as divers, rights as Nova Scotians, as citizens, who has appropriate access, who's allowed to do this, where are you allowed to do this? At what point can somebody tell you, no, you cannot enter these areas? And if we want to find out if they're telling the truth or not, or if they're just kind of trying to scare you, here's how you can find out if it's, you know, if this is the right direction. Do we have to call a bylaw officer? Do we have to call, I mean, nobody wants to call the police and say, hey, these people aren't letting us in the ocean. But we just want to make sure that we're doing everything by the book and respectful. Like, again, I've actually had a lot of conversations with the Surf Association of Nova Scotia, and they've had some great success with developing a bunch of surf sites. And they had a lot of pushback. A lot of locals, residents said, oh, you surfers, you're just going to, you know, wreck our beach and you're going to smoke weed and make a mess and all this stuff, yada, yada, yada. And when I talked to a lot of these guys, like, no, we just want to surf, man. Like, if we wreck the beach, then we don't have a beach to surf at. And it's the same for us. Mm-hmm. They had some great success in Cow Bay, where they were able to build a parking lot, better access to a great surf spot there. And I talked to a few guys about it. And I asked them, you know, hey, how did you get this done? Like, what was your success point? And one of them very blatantly said there was two major things that contributed to their quote unquote success, if you want to call that a success, which, you know, I do consider it. One was time. It took them, he told me, about seven years to get that to be properly made up as a dive site. Now, granted, we've been around for 3 years, 4 years now, and we're working as best as we can, and we've had some setbacks. So let's just set the time aside. The other was they had a generous anonymous donation. They wouldn't tell me who it was. They had to, he told me a lot of stuff that, he didn't tell me a lot of stuff. He basically said they were able to complete a lot of these things because they had a significant donation to their society to help promote these things and build these things. It was an ex-surfer, didn't want any publicity, didn't want a promotion, just said, hey, here's a good chunk of money. And when I talk a chunk of money, I'm talking most people's year salary of stuff. And that obviously helped jump a lot of hurdles. I said it, just kind of in jest a few minutes ago that the only people losing right now is me because I'm using a lot of my own money. I'm not losing thousands of dollars, but, you know, to and from Lunenburg, you know, a couple times a month and paying for asbestos testing. And, we collected a few fees and we did have some donations to the Underwater Council. Actually, we had a memorial donation set up for Paul Miles, an ex-member of the Underwater Council, the previous Underwater Council. And his widow reached out to me saying, you know, he was a very admirable member of the Underwater Council. And I think he would love to have donations made to you guys in his honor. And I was floored. I was like, that's amazing. That's so nice. And we'll definitely put together a little something. And we collected, a decent amount of money from those memorial donations. And we'll be putting that towards the Young Teaser project. And at some point when we are successful, we'll be able to put some sort of dedication to Paul Miles and to all the ex-members. And we really hope that people out there who have a passion for diving and want to see us succeed and want to help us out, do reach out. And we want to make sure that we're there for everybody else as well, because we're all in this together. That seems to be a phrase used way too much nowadays. But we're doing this for the community, and we're hoping we can be successful. But the only way is with community support in the end.
Yeah, and you know, I think you said it correctly there. It's like you really have to get the community to kind of rally behind the cause, and really, it's not a thing where I think anyone's running around setting up their retirement based on Nova Scotia Underwater Council participation, right? So, to that end, and you know, I got to say, I appreciate the efforts that you guys are putting forward to this. Everything that you're talking about, I mean, it's sparking so many thoughts in my head that I think we are going to have to get together and chat about this later on. But, you know, to what you were saying about how you can help support the Underwater Council, where can people follow you online or become an NSUC member or even just sign up for a dive course with you?
Well, we don't put on dive courses. The Underwater Council doesn't promote specific courses and such. But to get involved with the council, you can email myself at president@nsunderwatercouncil.ca or any of our members, secretary, vice president, treasurer at nsunderwatercouncil.ca. And then we have our info@nsunderwatercouncil.ca email that just is generically checked. We're on Facebook and we have a group there that's easily reachable. So direct message any of us and we do check that regularly. Unfortunately, I'm not the most savvy social media person, and so I don't post a whole lot in there, but I do check and keep involved with any messages coming in. Same with Instagram. And I am working on updating our website where we'll be able to keep tabs of more of our actual projects and how to be involved in there. And in the case of Paul Miles, it was as simple as his widow reaching out to me and asking via email, what can we set up? And we talked a few times and we're able to set up a process there. So if there are people out there, whether they're from Nova Scotia or, you know, across Canada or the rest of the world, wherever you're listening from, feel free to reach out to me. And I'm always up for a good chat about diving. You can tell I could ramble on for a while here, but I don't want to take up, a double issue of the podcast here. But yeah, reach out to us and we can surely, find a way for you to support, whether it's membership, or donation, or just an extra set of hands when we're ready to start lugging some garbage off the teaser.
And what keeps you diving, JP?
Oh man, just exploration and just something different. It's one thing to do something that not everybody does. And one of the common threads in a lot of the open water courses is a lot of lone wolves. A lot of people take diving that they come in, some come in with friends or a significant other, but, you know, a lot of us come in just to try something different and we find we like it. And then we just kind of band together and find a different group. None of my close friends dive. Nobody in my family dives. So it's always something cool that I can bring to them. And I've taken a few of them in a pool and I get to show them. So I'm always looking for new and interesting things to do. And I guess that's why I want to push the Underwater Council as well. Why I want to see more things in Nova Scotia. I want, more wrecks, more dive site, more promotion, more divers. The more divers that come here and start diving, the more that helps the local shops that we got here, the local tourism, the restaurants and bar industry, which I'm a huge fan of here in Nova Scotia. There's so much to do here. Why not add diving in? And to throw it into context, I won't quote the study because I don't have it, or I never actually saw it, but a friend of mine told me that a study was done years ago on kind of the quote unquote bang for your buck when it comes to investing in tourism. And that's, you know, if you were to take $1 million and give it to a golf course company, what's $1 million going to get you when it comes to a golf course? It might get you a hole or maybe two, if that. And it's not even going to, you know, touch the clubhouse or anything else. You give $1 million to the dive industry? Jesus, we could build dive shops all along the whole coastline here. We could buy all kinds of ship vessels and do all kinds of amazing things. The ocean's there. We have it here. Why aren't we using it more? We got boat tours. We got fishing tours. We've got beaches across. It's a little cold, but we still got great beaches. So why can't we put some money into the dive industry and bring in a whole nother sector of people who aren't worried about the cold? We can handle it. That's why we're doing it. So I think bang for your buck, you get a lot out of investing in the dive community. Now, for us, it may cost a little bit to start up, but hey, you know, that's why we love it, though.
Well, you know what? You said it well there, JP. I think often we can be a band of misfits that kind of come together. And, you know, I definitely resonate with you when you say that you got into it and nobody else did. I ended up as, you know, the lone guy on my course. And I don't know how long I waited for buddies to jump in. And I just finally was like, yeah, you know what? I got to do this. And certainly I've gotten hooked. So I think you're right. It's one of those things where we can bring together a whole pile of people from all walks of life and explore something that we've got in our own backyard. So, you know, I just wanted to say thank you very much for sharing some of your time with us and some of your knowledge, as well as, you know, some of the things that the Nova Scotia Underwater Council is doing to make diving more accessible here in Nova Scotia. So thank you. Thank you for coming on the show.
Well, guys, thanks for having me. And it's a pleasure to always, shoot the breeze on diving and everything that we're trying to do here. But man, there's just so much out there. I just want us all to enjoy it.
All right. Well, that was an awesome interview with JP. You guys seemed to have a good time chatting with him. And yeah, it was sad to miss it. Oh, well. Anyway. All right. April, what do you got for us tonight on Dive Girls Around the World?
Yeah. So, I mean, in the open, I told you guys I was going to tell you about an awesome Canadian girl, but it's actually going to be Canadian girls. So we just had Patty Women's Dive Day here, and we had our biggest Women's Dive Day event ever. So we had 50 girls in the water on July 17th, which, I mean, I know maybe in other parts of the world is not that many, but in Nova Scotia, it is very impressive.
It's a hell of an accomplishment, yeah.
Like, just thinking back to previous years where we would have our Women's Dive Day dive and 10 people would show up and two of them would be women. So I think, I think 50 women in the water is just like really awesome. So it was definitely like a cool day for me to just be like, wow, like everything that I've dreamt of for the Sea Foxes is kind of coming together, and look at all these women out and diving. So that was pretty cool. So I guess my dive girls around the world this week, I'm just shouting it out and sending it out to all of my Sea Foxes. And I mean, everyone from the, do I name names? Like, do I list off some? I don't want to forget anybody, but I mean, there's the girls who go out like every week, like Alana and Sarah and Jen and Malaya and all them who are there just killing it, to some of the girls like Bridget and Abby, who I certified, you know, the weekend before Women's Dive Day, and they're out there nice. Diving like immediately. So just everybody, I wish I could name all 50 names. I should have brought my list and showed them all out. But anyways, you guys are all my dive girls around the world this week. So happy belated Women's Dive Day. And, you know, you all inspire me. And I'm sure anybody listening to this pod, if they got to meet you, you'd inspire them too.
Awesome. Well, that sounds really great. And yeah, that's amazing. The turn of events for women's diving out here in Nova Scotia. I always say that that club is just unbelievably popular, and you get so many ladies out there diving so often. It's just really cool what you're doing, and I really appreciate it. And thanks, thank April, you. For that. And thanks to all you people out there listening. Thanks to thanks for sitting through another episode of Dive in the Podcast. I want to thank JP for coming on the show. I want to thank Nick for setting up the interview. Thank Amit for all of his work on the interview as well. And April, thank you for being on the episode.
Yeah, of course. I'm always happy to join for an episode of the pod.
Awesome.
Me and Amit, though, we realized that we're both going to be absent during February episode of 2022 when we're on Blackbeard's cruise. So you and Nick are going to have to do a solo episode unless you would like us to radio call you from the middle of the ocean in the Bahamas.
Are you telling me you can't invest in satellite internet for the podcast?
If our Patreons would like to donate, they can set us up with a, I don't know, what's it called? Satellite phone? So we can pod from the ocean.
There we go.
Yeah.
I don't see why that can't happen. They live broadcast from the Bahamas at Dean's Blue Hole for Vertical Blue. So there's no reason that we can't do a live stream from the boat on Blackbeard. Yeah.
Maybe the captain could be our guest that week. Oh, there we go.
See, this is all coming together, April.
It's all coming together. The link for our Patreon is in the show notes. Please donate so we can get our satellite.
we just need a little satellite internet. And
how much do those cost?
I don't know. Probably a lot. They're pretty expensive, actually. So I'm sure data on a satellite uplink is pretty expensive. At least they claim it is when you're on a cruise ship and they charge you $1 zillion per megabyte for internet. Yeah. So don't forget, as April said, you can support the podcast on Patreon at patreon.com/diveinpod and get some fun rewards to doing so. You can visit our website, diveinpod.com, for all the links you need for episodes, merch, and so much more. You can also find us on Facebook with a new Facebook group called Dive In. Just simply Dive In. That's managed by your hosts of the podcast. Just for fun, another way for us all to chat and communicate on there. We've also posted on there for everyone in Nova Scotia a link. Go vote for us in the Coast's Best of Halifax. On social media, you can follow me at iDiveOK.
I'm at April Weichert, and Nick is at Nicholas Winkler Photography.
Next week, we speak to Luca Melagudi. He is a Molchanov's freediving instructor and owner of Sea to Sky Freediving in beautiful British Columbia. This episode of Dive in the Podcast was brought to you by our sponsor, Torpedo Rays Scuba.
You can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or at podchaser.com. Reviews are one of the best ways to help others find the podcast. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
I won.
I think with lag, I lost. Dang it. I tried to get in there. Well, we both thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening.
Had to get the last song in, last word in.
I'm getting the last word in.